state lawmaker Kelly Cassidy says she's facing retaliation after calling for an investigation into sexual harassment allegations within the Democratic Party and the Madigan machine.
This is retribution. There is zero doubt in my mind that this is about me having the gall to speak out.
That's Representative Cassidy speaking to NBC Chicago about feeling forced to resign. Plus, getting evicted from your home can be devastating, especially for lower-income families. In Decatur, that rate is twice as high as the rest of the state. But first, three Central Illinois men accused of bombing a mosque in Minnesota last summer are facing new federal charges. This time in Illinois, it's just the latest in a series of alleged illegal actions.
I didn't see the gun, but I felt it, and it was steel, and it was cold, and I got two circles on my back from the barrel.
That's John O'Neill telling NPR about being held at gunpoint by one of the bombers, Michael Harry. NPR reporter Matt Sepik joins us. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've got a lot going on today. We're going to be talking later in the hour about the rate of housing evictions in Decatur. New data showing it's double that of the average in Illinois. We're also going to be talking about some big news in Illinois politics, including calls for investigations into House Speaker Michael Madigan and whether or not he used his influence to intimidate a female lawmaker who spoke out against him. But first, we wanted to update you on the case of three Central Illinois men accused of bombing a Minnesota mosque last summer who are now facing new federal charges. A grand jury alleges the three men, along with another Illinois local, put another bomb on railroad tracks near Effingham in southern Illinois. This incident is just the latest allegation against this group of men. It's a strange and complicated saga. And with us now is Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik, who's been following the Minnesota bombing case, and he's back to update us on the latest with this group of men. Matt, thanks for being with us. Welcome back to the 21st.
Glad to be here again, Nyla.
Matt, so we've got a group of gentlemen here, Michael Harry, Michael McWhorter, Joe Morris, and now a new name in the Ellis Mack to this group. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should just start with the original charges and the original case that you were covering, which was involving the Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center. That was last August, correct?
Right. The Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center is a mosque and community center in Bloomington, Minnesota, just a few miles down the road from the Mall of America here in the suburbs of the Twin Cities. And early in the morning on August 5th, there were five people gathered there for early morning prayers, and they hear the window break, and then a few seconds later, there's an explosion, and thankfully, no one was hurt, but the blast did quite a bit of damage to the area around the imam's outer office. It's since been repaired. The local FBI office here in Minneapolis made it a top priority to get to the bottom of this. And last March, they announced charges against three Illinois men who allegedly drove from the small town of Clarence, which is about a half hour from Champaign-Urbana, about a half hour north near the town of Paxton. The federal prosecutors alleged that these men drove 500 plus miles from east central Illinois to Bloomington, Minnesota, smashed the window of the Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center and set off a pipe bomb made of PVC pipe and, I believe, black powder.
Now, that's that case. There's a couple of cases involving the same group. Let's start with the latest, newest charges in regards to Effingham. What's that? What are those charges about?
Well, there are two parallel cases going here involving two federal jurisdictions. They're all federal charges. They've been charged here by federal complaint in Minnesota with arson, with the attack on the Dar el-Farouk Islamic Center in August. There's a separate complaint and then a grand jury indictment in the Central District of Illinois. Prosecutors in Urbana are handling that one, and that case appears to be going ahead of the case here in Minnesota. The men are facing a variety of charges. Michael Harry, who's 47 years old, from Clarence, is the alleged ringleader. Charged along with him are, as you mentioned earlier, Michael McWhorter. He's 29 years old. Joe Morris, who's 22, and then another person, a teenager, 18-year-old Ellis Mack. All four of these guys are from Clarence, and they're facing a variety of conspiracy charges for allegedly being part of this anti-government militia group. And among those charges, that one of them goes back to November. Three of the men, the same three, in fact, who are charged in the mosque bombing case, are alleged to have thrown a bomb through the window or inside of the women's health practice, a clinic that performs abortions in Champaign. That was in November. That bomb did not go off, but in addition to that charge, which is outlined in the superseding indictment that the grand jury in Urbana released earlier this month, they are charged with bombing or attempting to bomb Canadian National Railway tracks around the Effingham area. The indictment does not say whether the bomb actually went off, but it does allege that this was part of an extortion scheme where they allegedly threatened more bombings against the railroad if the railroad did not not pay them. It was an extortion scheme.
Or an attempted extortion scheme, it seems like. So this group, they, as you said, it's kind of a group of these men, and we have some audio of from YouTube of them. Let's play some of that.
We're speaking to you. We're the members of the White Rabbit, 3% Illinois Patriot Freedom Fighters Militia, and we're speaking to you from the Clarence, Illinois area, where we've had a crisis in the last something over a week. On the 19th of February, the FBI and local authorities showed up. They sealed off the north end of town. They searched a lot of properties with no consent, no warrant, no nothing. They told property owners to get lost. They blockaded driveways, wouldn't let people get home. I personally had my drive blockaded. They wouldn't let me into my own house or my own property. And they claimed it was because of some kind of bomb scare.
So that's from a YouTube video. Matt Sepik is with us on the line from Minnesota Public Radio, where he's based. Matt, do we know who this is who's speaking in this video?
Yes, that is Michael Harry. He is a, as I said, the alleged ringleader of this White Rabbit militia. He lives in Clarence, and prosecutors allege he organized this attack against the Darul Farooq Islamic Center here in Bloomington, Minnesota. And he and three alleged co-conspirators are charged with a variety of crimes related to this White Rabbit militia. That YouTube clip that you played was from March 4th, and he took to the internet wearing a ski mask. There's a video of him and his alleged accomplices all taking turns in front of the camera. Apparently, they only had one ski mask. So they took it off, switched places in front of the camera, put it back on, and each made an appeal for other like-minded anti-government folks to come to Clarence. And I believe they were hoping for some sort of grand showdown with federal authorities that fortunately did not happen. But to give that a little context, Nyla, that video was posted about a week after federal agents, FBI and ATF, showed up in Clarence on a report of bombs in a shed. But according to the indictment and the initial criminal complaint, Michael Harry and the other three men planted those bombs in the shed of Harry's neighbor. And his name is John O'Neill, and he is an innocent victim in all of this. He has a wife and three daughters and lives in Clarence. And there was a tip emailed into the ATF on February 19th saying that there were bombs in this shed. And what prosecutors are alleging here is that not only did Michael Harry and his co-conspirators plant those bombs in there, Harry actually called that tip or emailed that tip into the ATF in an attempt to frame John O'Neill because of a dispute they had back in July, which Harry is facing state charges for in Ford County. It is really quite a bizarre case. And it's, it as I've been telling my colleagues here, it's just not something that you can make up.
You really, Harry, you can.
And it's really just bizarre. Harry,
and you did, you did actually speak with John O'Neill.
I sure did, yes.
That's Harry's neighbor in Clarence. And I wanted to let's play some of that interview of this the first encounter that John O'Neill has with Michael Harry.
When he learned that I had been on his property, he pulled a gun on me and tried to stuff me in the back of his car. Yeah.
It was an airsoft gun, right?
No.
It wasn't.
It was not an airsoft gun.
Everybody there was probably 6 or 7 people that was there. Every single person told I was the only one that never saw the gun. But every single person that was there said that was not the gun. I didn't see the gun, but I felt it, and it was steel, and it was cold. And
I mean, if it was an airsoft gun, my husband wouldn't have scars, literally just scars all down his side from the gun.
Yeah, I got 2 circles on my back from the barrel. That was our first run-in with him.
You'd never met him before?
Never met him before. I was actually trying to introduce myself to him when he pulled that whole stunt.
That's Clarence, Illinois resident John O'Neill speaking to Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik, who's on the line with us now. So as you were saying, Matt, there's separate charges now with that instance. That was John O'Neill describing his first encounter with Michael Harry.
Correct.
But I guess that's actually what led this. That incident is what led the authorities to him, to the charges and the investigation of the mosque bombing in Minnesota?
It appears so. As I was mentioning earlier, that incident back in July where John O'Neill had complained about Michael Harry's dogs running loose and getting into his trash, that apparently really set off Michael Harry, led him to hold John O'Neill at gunpoint, stuff him into the back of a car, according to the state charges filed in Ford County. And O'Neill and his wife, Hope, continued to press those charges. Harry wouldn't let it go. And that's when he allegedly tried to frame O'Neill by planting these bombs in his shed and, according to the indictment, calling in a phony tip to the ATF and really putting himself on the radar of the feds who had been investigating this mosque bombing. And apparently people started talking. The federal investigators began hearing things and talk of a trip to Minnesota. And that's when they began putting 2 and 2 together.
And when did we know how authorities learned or how authorities decided to proceed with these charges regarding Champaign, the case in Champaign, and then also in Effingham with the railroad?
I'm not sure. All we know publicly is what is in the indictment and the criminal complaint. I've been keeping a close eye on all of the court documents filed in this case because this investigation is still ongoing and additional charges are expected here in Minnesota. You can imagine that federal prosecutors, certainly federal investigators, aren't going to be tipping their hand or speaking publicly about how they learned what. But there have been people talking to investigators. Late last year, the Ford County Sheriff was emailed some photos of some bomb-making materials, and he forwarded this to the FBI. So even before this incident in February, when the bombs were found on John O'Neill's property, Harry had been on the radar of federal investigators because of a tip that was sent in to the Ford County Sheriff.
And do we have any sense of, do authorities have any explanation? Have we heard anything about why they would drive all the way to Minnesota, 500, to commit this particular crime?
Well, that's a good question. There are The Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center, and this goes back to another case, too, of ISIS terrorist recruitment here in Minnesota. There were several suspects in that case who had attended or had met at the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center. That is not to say that they were ever radicalized there or learned anything there that would have led them to join an international terrorist group. But the center, as a result of that case, has gotten a lot of unwanted and unwarranted attention and has been blamed in certain circles for radicalizing these folks. And it has gotten around the internet, and that it may be what led the men in Illinois to target that particular mosque and not one that is not a day's drive away.
Right. So just a question in terms of, we just have about a minute left, but I just want to ask you very quickly, as we're thinking about that center in the middle of Ramadan, you said everything's been rebuilt?
Oh, yeah. And there was quite a bit of community support here. I believe the local Carpenters Union donated time and materials, and a lot of people in the Bloomington community came together and supported the members of the Dar al-Farouk Islamic Center and said, you know, we're behind you. Whatever you need, we'll help you. This is not acceptable for an attack like this to happen in our backyard in Bloomington, Minnesota.
So, Matt, there's now two different trials?
Well, no trials, not quite yet. There has been a trial date set for the federal charges in Illinois. That will be June 5th, tentatively. These things tend to get pushed back. As far as the Minnesota charges go, there hasn't even been an indictment yet. The prosecutors here have until June 22nd to get an indictment. They have an extension on the charges here. So I believe it's being worked out between the two U.S. Attorney's offices in Illinois and here in Minneapolis.
Thanks to Minnesota Public Radio reporter Matt Sepik. We'll link our last conversation with Matt and his other coverage to this at our website, 21stshow.org. Matt, thank you.
Coming up, you're welcome.
Yeah, coming up, we're going to be talking about the high cost of living, specifically rent, how much of a problem that is outside of Chicago. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When it comes to basic need housing, especially rent, can be one of your biggest needs and often the most challenging. And if you're not able to make ends meet and maybe you fall behind on your rent, eviction, of course, is the worst case scenario. For the first time, we're getting some comprehensive data on what evictions look like all across the U.S. It's based on information collected by Princeton University. Here in Illinois, 1.58% of renters were evicted in 2016, but in Decatur, the rate is double that. On the line with us to talk about this now is Tom Lisi, who's been reporting on this for the Decatur Herald and Review. Bob Palmer's also with us. He's on the line from Springfield. He's the Policy Director of Housing Action Illinois. Bob, Tom, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bob, I wanted to just start by asking, as I just said, the rate of evictions in Decatur is double that of the rest of the state. And we're going to get into some of the whys in a moment. But did this data surprise you?
Oh, you're talking to me?
To Bob, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So this is Bob from Housing Action Illinois. You know, the data was not surprising. We know all over the state there's a shortage of affordable housing. People often think of this as sort of a Chicago issue where housing is more expensive compared to the rest of the state, at least in certain neighborhoods. But in other parts of the state, based on the wages or the people earn or the incomes, they tend to be lower, and even though the rents are lower, there's still this gap. And so overall in the state, there's a shortage of over 300,000 rental units for people with the lowest incomes, and it's in all communities, Decatur, Springfield, Champaign, small towns in rural Illinois, everywhere.
And Bob, you and I were emailing before the show and you were just sharing some data with me. How much money does it take to be able to afford a 2-bedroom apartment in the Decatur area?
Well, in Decatur, you have to earn $13.40 an hour to afford the average rent on a 2-bedroom apartment. And with the minimum wage only being $8.25, again, a lot of people are spending, you know, 40, 50, 60% of their income on rent just to pay for housing. And if you have some sort of temporary crisis, loss of a job, a healthcare emergency, you know, something else, you're going to get behind on your rent, and that's going to put you at risk of it being evicted.
And Tom Lisi is with us as well. Tom, how would you describe the affordability of the housing market in Decatur, especially when we're talking about renters? We know that housing affordability, as Bob's saying, is a problem not just across Illinois, but across the country. What does it look like in Decatur?
Well, it's kind of ironic because Decatur has some of the lowest real estate prices, I think, in the country. It's certainly well below the national average, but rents are still kind of out of reach, like Bob said, for people, you know, making close to the minimum wage. So you still have rents, you know, in the $500, $600, $700 range and up if you're talking about 2-bedroom, 3-bedroom family-sized unit. So there is a real discrepancy there between, you know, actual housing property prices and how much rent is for most people.
And can you describe for us the geographic layout of Decatur and what you saw with the data where there have been the most evictions?
So, you know, Decatur, like, you know, most cities in the country, is there's sort of, you know, there are neighborhoods that are fairly middle class, even in the city limits. And then there are ones that have just sort of experienced a lot of disinvestment. And with a, you know, industrial city like Decatur in the Midwest, there's been population loss over the past few decades, and those neighborhoods are really struggling. And of course, you know, it's not a big surprise that those are the sort of areas that have the highest rate of evictions, and that's, you know, people who are really kind of not in stable situations. And, you know, if one thing happens to them, you know, one setback, whether it's a loss of job or a big medical bill, Christmas is one, getting gifts for family members, that can really kind of send you into a tailspin.
And you mentioned a loss of a job. Did you look at, is there a correlation between unemployment rates, the jobless rate, and eviction rates?
I didn't look at that specifically. I did see more of a correlation between poverty rate. But yes, I mean, I think anecdotally that's certainly the case. You know, Decatur does have quite a bit of job openings. That's one thing that gets talked about a lot locally is, you know, you still have a higher unemployment rate than the state and the nation, but there are these job openings. It's just that there's a skill gap. There's other issues there. So, it kind of gets into more complications around poverty and access to housing and sort of a lack of opportunity.
And Tom, what did local officials in Decatur say about this and about this number?
Well, you know, I actually didn't really speak to elected officials. I did speak to the director of the City Housing Authority.
That's who I meant, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, he absolutely is concerned that there is a, you know, affordable housing crisis, just kind of like you would think in bigger cities like Chicago, where there's just a lack of options as far as finding rent that people can afford.
Tom, this information, I said it was collected by Princeton University. Can you tell us more about this data, where it came from?
So, you know, there was a sociologist at Princeton, Matthew Desmond, who came out with a book a couple years ago that ended up winning the Pulitzer Prize. And he spent some time in Milwaukee talking to landlords, talking to tenants in various neighborhoods, and kind of shed some light on sort of not only how evictions work and what people go through, but also kind of the economy of affordable of low-income housing in struggling neighborhoods. And there's a lot of interesting trends that I think a lot of people were not really paying attention to after the mortgage, the financial crisis and the housing crisis with, mortgages in the 2000s, that people were not really thinking about renters in this case.
Bob, I wonder if we could chat about that for a minute, just what the factors are that lead to eviction. What do you think the weeks and days leading up to eviction look like for people when they're in these situations?
Well, I think people will do anything they can to try and avoid eviction, including, you know, not paying other bills, utilities, or credit cards or so forth, because obviously the huge impact it has. So it's a huge amount of stress on the family, and, you know, people will borrow money and so forth. But, you know, again, if you, at the end of the day, if you can't pay the rent, you're going to get evicted. And there's all sorts of, well, obviously that is a huge impact on the family, but there's all sorts of social costs, people entering the social service system, entering, you know, trying to find emergency shelter. You know, it makes it hard for kids to stay in school if their family's just been evicted. And so there's, you know, lots of long-term social costs for that in terms of, you know, getting prepared to be in the workforce and having the skills that you need to get for the jobs that are available. So it impacts both the family and the community.
That's Bob Palmer. He's the policy director of Housing Action Illinois. We're also speaking with Tom Lisi, a reporter with the Herald and Review in Decatur. And I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation, Jerry Peltz. He's the executive director of the Northeast Community Fund. They're a faith-based social service agency based in Decatur. Hi, Jerry. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you.
Jerry, you help with services around housing. To Bob's point about different social service agencies, what are you able to do and what are you doing specifically in Decatur to help folks who may be in a situation where they're having a hard time with housing?
While we can't pay rent directly, we are able to do a lot of supportive things for families. We are able to provide furnishings for the house. We are able to provide food, clothing, all of those at no cost. Some help with prescription medicines and co-pays. So what we are able to do is to free up more of the cash that might be siphoned off someplace else, so that it can actually be put directly toward rent. While we don't do rent, oftentimes I talk to people about the things that we can do for them so that they would have more cash available to actually pay their rent.
And Jerry, what do you hear from folks who are coming in to the Northeast Community Fund? Are these people who are working and having a hard time? Just as we've been talking about how when you're in a situation like this, how hard it can be. Are these people who are working? Are these people who are having unexpected expenses that they thought would happen? What are you seeing in Decatur?
I'm seeing a wide array of people that come in. There are certainly people who, as I think was mentioned before, the math just doesn't add up. You know, there's not enough income coming in to take care of the needs that they have, and especially if they're starting off anew, because not only is there rent, there's usually a deposit that is equal to 1 month's rent, so people actually have to come up with 2 months' rent sometimes to start. And the other thing that happens way too often is that people often are very mobile and, will change houses quite frequently. And, they think that they're getting something that's decent or good or is going to work for them. And after they've been there for a while, they figure out that isn't the case and they want to move. Or they may be evicted or whatever. And oftentimes when people are either evicted or move, they don't have the wherewithal to move all of their resources, their household goods, their furniture and stuff like that. So a lot of times we find that people kind of start over when they move.
Which is more expensive.
Yes.
Also. And I imagine, do you see both sides of this issue as well, Jerry, right? It's not easy to have to evict someone if you're a landlord.
Oh, I'm sure it's not. But as I've said before, it's I see both sides of the issue. I see renters who are do not respect or honor the, you know, the homes that they are leasing and try to take care of them. They pretty much trash them. I also see landlords that have decent tenants, and they refuse to make even some of the simplest repairs for them, you know, things like a broken screen door or a leaking pipe. And what I really see a lot is people coming in here who are renters and have $200-$300 water bills because they have a leaky pipe somewhere, and the landlord has not made that repair, and that just keeps adding up and adding up, and then puts just much more stress on the tenant. That's a fairly common occurrence.
I can imagine that. Tom, I wanted to ask, when it comes to eviction, how much do local laws come into play here? Because I know the laws can differ depending on, of course, I know it's different whether you're in public housing versus a private housing stock, but what does it look like in Decatur in terms of eviction law?
Well, it's pretty much determined by state law. So Illinois does have some state statutes that require evictions to go through the courts. So the landlord does have to provide an eviction notice, and that's served to the tenant, and there is a preliminary hearing. So you do have to go to court, and there's an initial proceeding, and if the tenant wants to challenge it, they can go into a civil court proceeding. So tenants will go into court. A lot of the times it's to ask for more time to leave. It's rare, I think, that tenants will actually try to challenge the landlord and say, you know, there will be cases where they'll say, hey, you didn't do this, you didn't do this. But a lot of the times it really comes down to just the tenant couldn't pay rent and they have to leave. So that's usually how the proceedings go. So there are other steps that can happen if there's, more difficulty in getting the tenant to leave. But by and large, once a tenant gets an eviction notice, they kind of take that as, you know, writing on the wall and they leave.
And Bob, is there recourse for tenants who are having a hard time with landlords that don't repair things? Like, I imagine that's a tough situation.
At the state level, there is very little. Chicago, by comparison, does a very, very strong landlord tenant law that gives tenants more resources in these situations. But the provisions related to that in state law are very, very minimal.
And speaking of state law, Bob, you're on the line from Springfield, where I know right now Housing Action Illinois is advocating for more funding to help prevent these situations. What do you think the state's role should be in all of this?
Well, the state does have a very successful, albeit small, program called the Homelessness Prevention Program that's been around since 1999. And it does make one-time grants that are targeted to families that are really having a temporary crisis, not a long-term crisis, but a temporary crisis, short-term job loss or an increase in healthcare costs, and through a grant of $700 or $1,000 that can be used for rent or utilities, it can keep a household in their home, and it avoids all the costs to them as individuals and also to society that are related to evictions, and also makes the landlord whole on their rent, and the landlord does have to agree to participate in the program. So several years ago, funding for this program was at $11 million, but now we're at $4.9 million because of the state's ongoing fiscal problems. But now that the state budget situation is a little better, we are trying to get that increased in the budget the General Assembly is currently working on by $2 million for the next fiscal year so more families can be assisted. What happens is many agencies who operate these programs in Decatur, it's a Salvation Army, they wind up running out of funds, and so they're only able to assist a relatively small percentage of the households that reach out to them who could be have their eviction prevented.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's Bob Palmer with Housing Action Illinois. I want to thank Jerry Peltz with the Northeast Community Fund, Tom Lisi as well. If you want to read more of Tom's reporting on this, you can visit our website, 21stshow.org. Coming up next, our weekly dose of Illinois politics. We are going to be talking about the budget and more. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo.
This is retribution. There is zero doubt in my mind that this is about me having the gall to speak out.
A state representative, Kelly Cassidy, speaking to NBC Chicago earlier this week, she's saying that House Speaker Michael Madigan retaliated against her after she spoke out against him and she had no choice but to resign. This is part of the conversation we're about to have about state politics. One of our favorite guides into this sometimes confusing world is Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey, who is on the line right now. Hey, Brian, how are you doing?
Good, Nyla. How are you?
Let's start with Kelly Cassidy in this story. Can you tell us just a little bit about what was going on here? First of all, she's a Democrat in Chicago, Kelly Cassidy?
She's a Democratic state representative from the north side of Chicago. And she was one of the people who was critical of Speaker Madigan. And there were some harassment allegations, not against the speaker himself, but against his political operation and some people in his operation. And that has actually turned into a lawsuit now. But she called for an independent outside review of that, which the speaker says is the move that he took. But she says, and this is where it gets a little complicated, but she also has a part-time job running a program for the Cook County Sheriff, Tom Dart, who's also a Democrat, also a former state representative in Madigan's house. And she says that shortly after she had made this critique of the speaker and his handling of this matter, the speaker's chief of staff called over to sort of confirm that she was still employed there, which she and somebody else that she cites in the office took as a sort of a veiled threat about her job.
And so she says basically there's a couple more things that happened, but basically she says she felt like she was forced to resign. And then she came out publicly with this, speaking to Marianne Ahern in Chicago, a reporter with NBC.
That's right. And so this week, she, as you said, she went public with this. The speaker pretty quickly, at her request and as other people have called for, he's denied this, that he directed anyone on his staff to make any of these inquiries about her job, and denies that there was any sort of retaliation. And he referred the matter to the legislative inspector general to investigate. This is the quasi, I don't know how you say it, sort of prosecutorial. It's an attorney, a former assistant U.S. attorney who's currently holding that position. There was kind of a dust up late last year when it came out, sort of as the Me Too movement was taking off. It came out that Illinois, this position had been vacant for
quite
a long time.
Right, so now there actually is an inspector general.
So there is a temporary legislative inspector general who should, seemingly, if she takes up this referral, will be investigating this. But we don't really get to learn about what that office is doing while it's happening.
And we saw some calls yesterday also, the Senate Women's Caucus also getting involved, saying they want the IG's office to investigate this as well.
Yeah, exactly. And, the timing of that, it came into my inbox almost at the same time. I think it actually, the email came within the hour of when I had already gotten a notification or a copy of the letter that the, you know, that the speaker spokesman put out saying that he had made that referral. So events were moving very quickly this week. You know, this is not, you know, the idea that somebody does something that is politically unpopular and then would face retaliation is not an entirely new thing in Illinois government. You'll be shocked to learn, I'm sure, you know, which is, again, what's alleged, not what's been proven, but what's been alleged here. On the other hand, given the sensitivities around retaliation and the Me Too movement and the fact that there is a lawsuit, you know, alleging retaliation against the speaker's political organization, the idea that, you know, why was the chief of staff calling the, you know, Cook County Sheriff, if indeed that's what happened, as was alleged in the story. You know, and this has an interesting resonance, too, I think. I was remembered that it was about 10 years ago, there was a story under the Blagojevich administration. He had begun retaliating against family members of legislators, and it was, in fact, Speaker Madigan's chief of staff whose own wife lost a state contract that she'd had for 20 years under Governor Blagojevich because he was started going after political enemies. So, I mean, again, I'm not saying that that's what happened here, that that's what the allegation is, and we'll have to wait and see how the investigations play out.
I wanted to ask you about within the State House another conversation that's happening, a debate around the death penalty that's been going on, and we talked about this a little bit last week. But Governor Rauner has proposed to reinstate the death penalty for the killing of police officers and for mass murder as part of an amendment to the guns bill. What's been the latest with that? There's been a lot of conversation about this in the State House, right, Brian?
Yeah, there was a subject matter hearing this week. I don't see a lot of, I think it was a subject matter hearing. I was actually off that day. But, you know, this, I don't think a lot of people view this as a sincere, like something that's, you know, really a legislative priority of the governor, something he really wants to get done. We should point out, you know, the way he introduced with this was by rewriting it into an amendatory veto of a gun bill that, you know, he didn't want to just deal with straight on. He did it as he had his own sort of working group that he had appointed to look at public safety matters was still meeting and dealing with this issue, trying to, you know, respond to a number of the mass killings and school shootings we've had in recent months. And, you know, by doing it this way, I think a lot of people don't really think that this is a serious proposal. You know, the speaker sort of called his bluff and you know, directed that it be put on another bill. There's a lot of legislative wrangling that goes into this. I think the bottom line is I don't think a lot of people are expecting that there will be a serious attempt to revive the death penalty. However, when the governor is trying to appeal to hardcore conservative voters after having barely won his legislative primary, you can imagine that, you know, reinstating the death penalty for people who kill police and sheriff and other law enforcement officers, as well as for people who kill more than one person, could be, you know, politically popular.
We actually have some audio from a Democratic State Representative Karen Yarbrough talking about this at a House committee hearing on Monday. Let's hear what she had to say about this.
I believe that we can have justice without the death penalty. We know that the death penalty is hard to apply fairly. We know it's extremely expensive to litigate, and we know it doesn't deter crime.
That's Democratic State Representative Karen Yarbrough at a House committee meeting on Monday. We did have a longer conversation about this, I should say. We'll tweet out a link to that if you're interested in more of an in-depth conversation we had about these, some of these issues that Representative Yarbrough was just bringing up. And to that point, Brian, I imagine Democrats are saying that this is really a political, the charges that this is just a political move by the governor and not anything that they're taking seriously. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, I think they're taking it seriously just, you know, to the extent that, you know, they don't want to be painted as not taking the issue of, you know, police officers being targeted, you know, to the extent that's happening, they don't want to be seen as, you know, not taking that seriously. The governor raised the issue. To some extent, it has to be dealt with now. But, you know, and this is maybe getting a little too much into the process. But, you know, there is a long line of both Supreme Court case law as well as House rules that you know, under Speaker Madigan, that govern the way amendatory vetoes are dealt with. And this is just not the way to make a serious policy proposal. I mean, Governor Pat Quinn 4 years ago tried to rewrite the concealed carry bill to do a bunch of different stuff, and the legislature rejected that. There's just a long track record of governors trying to sort of introduce their own legislative agendas through this amendatory veto process. And it's just the legislature just does not view that as the way to go about things.
Moving to the budget, I wanted to ask you about a lawsuit that was just filed. A group of school superintendents, Brian, are suing Governor Bruce Rauner in the state of Illinois for schools.
Yeah, I mean, so that we had this big funding change last year, and I think the legislature is kind of hoping to gradually ramp up the amount of money that it's sending to schools to try and, you know, promote equity for, you know, rich districts, poor districts, that sort of thing. But the school superintendents, much like the State Board of Education, are saying we need a lot more money right away. So it's very early, but, you know, the total cost, I think they're saying, is $7.2 billion. So it's not as though Illinois is swimming in cash, even with last year's tax increase. There is still a budget deficit for the current year, for next year, that people are trying to deal with. But this is, you know, we've certainly seen budget fights move into the courts in recent years, and this is just the latest front in those battles.
I'm speaking with Illinois Public Radio State House reporter Brian Mackey. Brian, as we are thinking about, the deadline is ticking down for a budget agreement. Session ends, I believe, next Thursday. Is it May 31st? Is
mm-hmm.
that
That's the
deadline?
Scheduled
That's
session,
the scheduled
yes.
end of session. We're different picture from last year, because we're certainly seeing lots of action of meetings, correct, between leadership, both Republican and Democrat, in the State House over this issue?
Yeah, and you know, in a normal situation, it'd be a low bar to say that people are meeting on the budget and that's some sign of progress. But in fact, it is a sign of progress. I think the big overarching question here is whether the governor wants to really sign a budget deal, right? He put forth a proposal earlier this year that, you know, called for spending all of the tax increase that passed over his veto last summer, and yet he is still campaigning against the tax increase. And so there's some question about, you know, does the governor want to be involved in whatever the final budget resolution is? Does he want to put his name on it, or does he view it as, you know, that he ought to take a stand for his principle, if you want to look at it in the positive way? The more cynical way would be to say, you know, does he want to be able to campaign on the fact that he vetoed the Democrats' tax and spend budget or something like that? And so that's the question. Does the governor want to make a deal?
Well, and I wonder, when we look at what happened last year, and certainly as we've heard from everyone from Comptroller Susana Mendoza to Senate leadership or other, I'm thinking of Senate President Cullerton, they've made comments saying we don't necessarily need the governor to pass a budget.
Yeah, I mean, but then you're talking about, right, so the Democrats have a veto-proof majority in the Senate, but the Democrats do not in the House. And so you would still need, if the governor is going to veto the budget, you would still need Republican votes in order to override him. Now, there are a number of lame ducks, some of the Republicans who crossed over to help Democrats raise taxes and end the budget impasse last summer, could theoretically be brought on board, but one would also imagine that they would want, and they have said, I mean, in my own reporting, they've said, look, we would like the governor to be involved. It is not, you know, their preferred option that they would override the governor. At least that's not what they're saying publicly. But, you know, there's this question out there. Does the governor really want to make a deal at the end of the day?
And I guess the question is do we have a sense from Democrats and Speaker Madigan, how much of is it? We would say at least they're meeting, so maybe we have a sense of the tone of being more conciliatory. I don't know if conciliatory is the word, but just more cooperative, given the fact that it's an election year. And while Governor Rauner is campaigning, there are lots of Democrats that are campaigning as well.
Yeah, look, and I mean, this is bad for our business, right? To say, like, you really shouldn't pay attention to the bouncing ball in the day by day at the end of the session here, because there will be skirmishes and there will be blow ups and people will walk angrily out of meetings and say that, you know, there were setbacks and things like that. But ultimately, what matters is, do you have a budget in place for the start of the new budget year on July 1st? And so that's what the thing to watch for is. Really, I think, given that it is an election year, nobody wants to go into the sort of overtime summer session. People would, I think, like to wrap up on May 31st for a change. I know I would certainly appreciate that. But, you know, the legislature, that's the deadline in order to, you know, for the regular session in order to pass a budget. So people are still generally optimistic that I talk to down here, but, you know, we'll just have to wait and see.
That's Illinois Public Radio's Brian Mackey. Brian, thanks for being with me. Appreciate it.
Good to talk to you, Nyla.
Coming up on the program tomorrow, a new report from researchers at the University of Illinois finds that 90% of nurses in Illinois experience violence on the job at least once in the past year. Tomorrow on the 21st, we're going to be talking about a House bill that would require better violence prevention training. If you have a comment on anything you heard on today's program or other news happening in our state, you can always call our voicemail line. That's 217-300-2121. Again, 217-300-2121. You can also email us at talk@21stshow.org. That's all the time we have for today. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. By the way, you can always head to our website, 21stshow.org. That's got information on how to follow us on social media, how to leave us a voicemail, how to send us an email, where to give us feedback. All you have to remember is 21stshow.org. 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day. See you back here tomorrow.